Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Today, we're in our fourth week in our seven-part legal series, and I'm joined today, as always, with my co-producer, Joe Caruso. Joe, welcome to today's, we're at the midway point of our legal series.
Yeah, we've had some action-packed and fun-filled shows, and we've got more great shows to come.
You know, Joe, I think really today's show, as we talk about, franchise compliance basics, earnings claims, / FPRs, is really an interesting topic right in the middle of the series, because no matter what we talked about, you know, previously with franchise outsourcing last week with Mark Kirsch, the week before social media and technology with Lee Plave, of course, the series started with private equity and franchising with Lane Fisher, and great shows coming up, which I'll get you to tell us a little bit about here in a second. But I really feel today's show is really the centerpiece, because without franchise sales, and really what we'll be talking about is franchise sales best practices, especially from a legal perspective, is really the cornerstone that everything hinges upon. So I really think that it's perfectly placed within the series, and I'm definitely looking forward to listening to our guest again on Franchise Today, and specifically within this franchise legal series, Warren Lee Lewis of Ackerman Centerfeet. But before we get into that, why don't you just give us a snapshot of what to expect as we head down the home stretch in our third annual franchise legal series?
Oh, I'm happy to do it. And Paul, I do think you're exactly right in talking about today's show on franchise compliance basics and earnings claims, especially since, you know, this being the centerpiece, it was no accident that this is the topic and that Warren is our guest today, because the whole series really, the underlying theme is compliance, and it's really what franchisors and franchise professionals struggle with all the time, because there's a lot of misinformation, there's a lot of mythology and romanticism associated with compliance, and a lot of times they're learning the compliance basics from people who maybe are not quite compliant, and I think that the whole series helps promote those best practices and dispel some of the mythology and the misinformation that's out there. And there's not a better lawyer to have on than Warren, since he wrote a great book, The Franchise Seller's Handbook, and he lives and breathes compliance and is able to communicate that to his clients, and he's graciously agreed to communicate it to our audience. But moving on to the rest of the series, we've got litigation, technology, and franchising. It's complicated with Ken Prine. Then we go on to having Michael Webster of the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers talking about the dynamics of winning franchisee-franchisor relationships. And then our last show of the series will be what do franchise lawyers talk about, the 2012 IFA Legal Symposium recap with Ursa Jackson, who will be our guest on that show. And then we'll be done with the third annual legal series.
Yep, and then we'll be going on hiatus for the summer, and we'll be rebroadcasting key shows of Franchise Today, probably a lot from this legal series as well as some of the previous two legal series. And that'll really be interesting to listen to, especially if we have several in a row by the same speaker, because it always seems to be a continuation, and we always seem to be building upon information that we previously shared. And then, of course, that'll take us all the way through Labor Day and then start the fourth season. Wow, I can't believe it's four seasons already, and I can't believe we're in the fourth week of this legal series. Time sure flies. And I want to remind everybody, a previous guest on Franchise Today about 5 or 6 weeks ago, Catherine Monson, CEO at Fast Signs, that will be on CBS Undercover Boss tomorrow night. I'm really excited because Catherine is the third franchise CEO that is on CBS Undercover Boss that's been a guest on Franchise Today. The other two were, of course, Shelley Sun of Brightstar and Dina Dwyer Owens of the Dwyer Group. So it's really exciting as we become the, in essence, the minor leagues for CBS Undercover Boss and franchising, but certainly very proud to have those people on. But, you know, today, our guest this morning is Warren Lee Lewis, this morning in the Central and Pacific times and certainly afternoon on the East Coast. And Warren Lee Lewis is chair in franchise and licensing practice at the law firm of Ackerman Centerfeet in Washington, D.C. Warren's practiced franchise law for more than 27 years. He's authored numerous franchising articles and business publications. He has testified before Congress and frequently speaks at U.S. and international franchise conferences. He actually published a study on the use of earnings claims by U.S. franchisors back in 1988, which has been cited favorably by the Federal Trade Commission and the Committee on Small Business of the U.S. House of Representatives. And he released a second study on the same topic in 1992. Warren also founded the Capital Area Franchise Association, where, of course, our co-producer, Joe Caruso, is currently president, and I've been honored to be a speaker. And we couldn't begin a show on franchise-compliant basics and earnings claims without again mentioning Warren's 2010 desk reference, The Franchise Seller's Handbook, which we feel is the must-have guide for every serious franchise executive. Warren, welcome back to Franchise Today.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here. I appreciate being invited back, and Joe also. Thank you very much.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to kind of dispel some myths and take us down the path with respect to, you know, earnings claims, FPRs, compliance, basics. And I know in our little introduction that we put out there online, we really felt that really feel that you have a great way of taking our listeners down that whole path of the who, what, where, when, and how of franchise disclosure laws, the culture of compliance, key opportunities, pitfalls and penalties associated with franchise sales, and hopefully be able to share a little bit more insight and perspective to our listening audience about FPRs, because it seems like, as Joe said, you know, a lot of them have a misconception of it or like to avoid it. So we'll just dive right into it. And, you know, you've had a great deal of experience coaching and advising startup franchisors through established franchisors, big and small. What are some of the common trouble areas or better, areas of confusion that you've recognized when it comes to the FTC franchise rule, whether it be, you know, or and state franchise and business opportunity disclosure laws? What is some of that confusion that you've seen?
Well, the confusion comes from primarily the fact that there's not one law. There are about 41 primary laws and probably hundreds of other laws that peripherally apply to franchise sales. But the main law is the FTC franchise rule. And then you have various state franchise disclosure laws, some of which require registrations. And then you have business opportunity laws that require disclosure. So in that setting, there's so much opportunity for miscommunication, misunderstanding, confusion, because the laws are not consistent. The Federal Trade Commission follows its own rules, and each of the states can follow their own rules, and they're not necessarily consistent. I mean, just some of the areas that I see, very, very common misconceptions. Some people think that the Federal Trade Commission requires some type of filing. There is no filing with the Federal Trade Commission. It just has a rule, and you're supposed to follow the rule. And if you don't, then they can come after you. Whereas the states do require filings. Not all of them do, but 10 of them require full registration. Some of them, 6 of them, require notices, and then other states also require notices. So there's a difference there between the FTC and the states. Also, the Federal Trade Commission now under the amended FTC rule really focuses on the sale of the franchise. And so sometime at least 14 calendar days before the sale or before you collect any money from the prospective franchisee, you're required to deliver an FDD, a franchise disclosure document. Now, so that's the focus on sale, but in the states, they focus on offer and sale. And under the state laws, an offer would mean any time that you're talking to someone. So there's confusion. Some people think, oh, geez, if I'm just talking to somebody in a state, am I really covered? Yes, you are really covered. You may not be covered under the FTC rule, but you are covered under the state law. So you need to know where that prospect is located. And the other misconception is if you're complying with the FTC rule, then you must be complying with all the state laws. That's not correct. The FTC rule creates a minimum set of requirements, and then the state laws can add to those requirements. They can't take away from the requirements at the federal level, but they can definitely add to the requirements, and they do add to the requirements. For example, at the FTC level, if things change and there's some material difference that you need to let people know about, you're not required, except quarterly, to update your disclosure document. However, at the state level, if things change, if there's a lawsuit filed against you or some other adverse event occurs, you have to immediately or promptly update your disclosure document. So those are some areas where there's, franchisers think, oh, I'm covered because I'm complying with the FTC rule. Well, that may not be enough, depending on where you're located or where the prospect is located.
So basically, it's not enough just to have, the documents in place. It really takes a full understanding, and I think, obviously, one check mark in the negative column for the document mills that are out there for sure. And it is a complex world. And given the changes with the 2008 FTC rule, and of course the harmony and disharmony with states' rules that regulate franchising, if you would, Warren, walk us through the required practices, the ones that are imperative for a franchisor to get right.
Okay. And you had mentioned it earlier. We can look at it from different angles, who, what, where, when, and why, and also how. And in terms of who, in terms of the requirements that apply to who's required to do things, the franchisor, its directors and officers, definitely have requirements imposed on them. And then anyone who acts as a franchise seller for a franchisor is covered by the requirements. And a franchise seller is basically anyone who is a liaison between the franchisor and the prospective franchisee during that sales process. And so that could include brokers, consultants, employees of the franchisor, or anyone else who's representing the franchisor. So they're covered by the requirements. And then the franchisees, state regulators, and FTC people are not covered by the requirements, but they're there to watch to see if you are complying, and if you aren't, they have remedies against those who are covered by the requirements. In terms of what is involved, the minimum required is an updated franchise disclosure document, and that includes all your agreements, your financials, various receipts, and disclosures. Then in certain states, you're required to be registered with the state. And then in terms of the other requirements apply to your marketing materials, your internet communications, website, and then the final agreements that you present to the prospect. Where you are located and where the prospect is located are extremely important because requirements change. If you're located in a certain state and they're located, for example, in Maryland or Illinois, New York, or California, you probably need to be registered to talk to those people. If they're located in Pennsylvania or some other non-registration state, then you may be able to talk to them, without having to register anywhere. And this, in terms of the, not only where they're located, but where you might have any meetings with them, and where the franchise business will be operated, all play into what requirements apply. And then there are various timing requirements. We just passed one of the timing requirements. Most franchisers have a fiscal year end of December 31. All of those franchisers were required to update their disclosure documents by the end of April, 120 days after their fiscal year end. So that's just a timing requirement that we just passed. So all franchisers should be using updated franchise disclosure documents. And then offers and sales need to be made while registrations are effective. So no offers and sales can be made before a registration becomes effective or after it becomes effective. And then when you're dealing with a prospect, you have to give them the franchise disclosure document at least 14 calendar days before they sign any binding contract or pay you anything. And then if you provide them, well, you will be required to provide them with final agreements for their signature, you should wait 7 calendar days. You're actually required to wait 7 calendar days in most situations before you have them sign those contracts. In terms of why, the requirements are there because the regulators want you to provide franchisees with appropriate information before they purchase franchises, and they, from your standpoint as a franchiser, you don't want to be penalized. So that would be why you need to comply with those requirements. And then finally, how, and I addressed this in the Franchise Seller's Handbook, this is not something you can do off the top of your head. You really do need some legal advice as you go along, and you can't possibly know the rule in every situation because the requirements don't always fit common sense. Often they go against common sense, but they are the requirements, so you have to follow them. And so you have your basic steps of compliance. There are about 11 of those. You have special disclosure situations such as renewals and transfers. And then during the sales process, you have certain activities that are permitted and certain activities that are prohibited. And so you have about a total of 32 basic rules. And then different rules apply whether you're using paper, electronic, or having face-to-face meetings. So a lot of requirements. It depends on where you are, who you're dealing with. And you shouldn't do it on your own. You do need guidance as you go along from someone who knows what they're that knows all the legal requirements.
Well, certainly you went through all the questions, and we left out why. And of course, the answer to that is it's because it's the law, right?
It's the law, and right. The why you comply is that if you don't comply, there are penalties. So. And you want to make why too. The basic why is you want to make franchise sales first of all. So, and you want to make them that you want them to stick. I mean, the worst thing is to make a franchise sale, train the person, and then find out weeks or months later that you did something wrong in the process, and then have to go through the potentially some type of rescission or offer them to refund their monies. I mean, it's just not something. It's a waste of effort for everyone.
Sure. And just a sidetrack here, because we have the International Franchise Expo coming up in New York, as it has been changed from typically being in or traditionally being in Washington, D.C. in April, now will be in New York at Jacob Javits Convention Center. It'll be Father's Day weekend. And, of course, New York being one of the registration states. I mean, how does franchise registration work with this expo coming up and this 3-day window of working with candidates in New York?
Well, as you mentioned, I mean, it was previously in Washington, D.C., where you weren't required to be registered. The safest approach would be to be registered in New York, because otherwise you're in a position where it may be that some people you're meeting, it may be that the New York law doesn't apply, or there may be exemptions that might apply to those people. So perhaps there would be situations where you're not required to be registered. But for most of those people, I would assume they'd be perhaps New York residents looking to operate New York businesses. So it would be advisable, I would think, to be registered so that you'd have the freedom to talk to those people.
Now, I understand there was some type of exemption given for those 3 days to be able to talk to the people for those 3 days, and I think that was given by the state of New York. But what I find really humorous about it is, you know, what happens on Monday? Does the conversation, you know, just end? So, you know, absolutely, to your point. If you haven't already done so, do everything you can to get registered going in. I mean, it does make sense.
It's the safest approach.
Yeah. You know, Joe, I know you were asked by the IFA to testify at the Maryland House of Delegates on a bill to harmonize the disclosure waiting period, which was successful. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a recap of that and how this all applies when we're talking about, the FDD and registrations and what have you?
Yeah, it was interesting. That was my first time ever having to testify or work on a particular piece of legislation with elected officials. And I went down and met with Delegate Dana Stein in Annapolis, Maryland. He's in the House of Delegates. And he was a co-sponsor of the bill. And it was interesting. He happens to be an attorney. And his first question to me is, why is this important? Because Maryland was still on the 10-day rule as opposed to being on the 10 business day rule as opposed to being on the 14 calendar days. And it actually took me a while to explain to him why this was important and wasn't just a minor consideration. And as we spent an hour or so talking about it, we came to the conclusion that it would be better for me to give written testimony than to actually do live testimony, so that the message would get across in an unambiguous way and that people would in the committee would understand why the bill was important. And so we wrote the testimony, I gave written testimony, and he presented it to the committee, and subsequently the bill was passed, and now Maryland is on the 14 calendar day rule as opposed to the 10 business day rule. But it was kind of interesting that our elected officials don't necessarily know what bills they sponsor and what they're voting on all the time, and they have no clue why it's important to the people or businesses that the bills might affect.
Yeah, Joe, you and I talk a lot about best franchising practices, and I know you have a specific question for Warren with respect to that.
Well, in terms of what people are required to do, that's one thing. But I'm really curious of what Warren's thoughts are on what best franchise practices, the practices that are going to be essential in building a durable and sustainable franchise system. You know, what are they? Can we kind of single those out that are really imperative and essential for franchisors to take to heart and really make part of their culture?
Sure. Well, I mean, yes, there are many, many requirements, but in terms of best practices, I would rank four as being the top four best franchise practices. Number one would be that there be a culture of compliance within the franchise organization, and that must be top down. So there needs to be a direction from the top, from the president or the owner of the company, that there is to be compliance, that they need to show that they're complying. They need to provide adequate training to people so that they can comply, and they need to keep communicating to people that they want there to be compliance. If there isn't that, then people tend to drift away from all of these various technical rules, which they can be criticized, oh, they're just technicalities. But if just that technicality can get you into trouble and require you to have to give refunds or enter into orders with states and be penalized. So there needs to be that culture. rather than a culture of, oh, let's, we'll never, you know, who, no one's going to complain, or we'll keep them happy. I see that, and it doesn't, it may work for a while, but it doesn't work long term. Number two would be that there be someone in the company who's strong and knowledgeable, who can say no, particularly to franchise salespeople. So, and that generally is best not, it's best to be an administrative type person, not the president or the vice president of sales, because they're focused on other broader issues and don't really have the time to, you know, when Monday morning comes and the salesman wants a disclosure document for Maryland, the president often is just not going to have the time to focus on, are we properly registered, et cetera. Whereas if you have a sales administrator, they would say, we're not registered yet, you need to wait a certain amount of time, or yes, we can, and give them the appropriate disclosure document. Without that, you just have people, if they can just pick the disclosure document off a desk someplace and use it, they may not be using it at the right time, in the right place, or even the right version of it. And then the third important best practice is that there be systems in place. They could be based on software that's used by the company. There could be written procedures. That would be the best thing to have, some basic written procedures and checklists. It could be on the computer. It could be in paper. And there should be a good filing system to keep track of when communications occurred, keep receipts. I mean, by law, you have to have receipts, but it's good to have receipts even if it weren't required by law, because then you know exactly when the person received the disclosure document. So you do need to have systems in place, and you need to have someone who follows those systems and then periodically monitor it. I've had situations where the top executive in the company has assured me, oh, no, we have systems in place, there's no problem. And then when we take a quick look at what's happening there at the administrative level, we find that the systems aren't being followed. And that is really an eye-opening situation where you put effort into developing the systems, but then you don't actually monitor them. So that's key. And then the other thing, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, there's no way a layperson or even a lawyer, even a franchise lawyer, can off the top of their head in every situation know the rule and know what to do. It's just not possible. There are just too many variables, too many tricky situations that come up that maybe you've never dealt with before. So you need to have cost-effective and competent legal advice. That some franchisers have lawyers on staff, so they can go into the office and ask a question and get a quick answer. In many situations, you ought to have somebody on call if you don't have somebody in-house, somebody outside, who you can call, and they can just give you an answer. It may just be a five-minute telephone call where they, you know, can I talk to this person in California? And the answer is yes or no, and then at least you know the answer. But if to try to do that on your own, when you're not day-to-day looking at all the rules and all the interpretations of the rules, is a very dangerous thing to do.
We're here on Franchise Today in our fourth segment of the third annual Franchise Legal Series. Our guest today is Warren Lee Lewis of Ackerman Centerfeet, and we're talking about right now franchise sales best practices. And I'm very happy to announce to our listeners that Warren will send you free of charge a signed hard copy of his indispensable and handy desk reference book, The Franchise Seller's Handbook. All you have to do is email Warren at warren.lewis@ackerman.com with franchise book in the subject line. And if for some reason you forget that, just go to Franchise Today on Facebook and put in your request, and we'll make sure that Warren receives that request and that you receive the Franchise Seller's Handbook. Warren, I heard you mention building a culture of compliance within a franchise organization. What do you mean by culture of compliance? I mean, it sounds easier said than done.
Well, I mean, you really need to be dedicated to it. And there need to be perhaps penalties if people don't comply, or hopefully you don't even get to that point. You can't just say you want to comply. You really have to show people, and it's generally in the smaller companies in particular, the president or the owner needs to show them that they comply, they seek they're willing to spend the money that it takes and maintain the systems that it takes to comply. If there's a feeling that, oh, yes, it's just a, you know, we have to do it, it's too bad, what a pain, it can get, that filters down and people view it as a, you know, painful experience. It may be painful, but it's important. And the culture has to be, okay, it may be painful, it may be technical, but we need to do it because long term, we're building a solid foundation here. We don't want to sell 50 or 100 franchises and then find out later that there were defects and then have a big emergency type situation develop because franchisees are saying that you did things wrong. I've seen it happen. It can destroy a system. So you need to have that culture that you're building on from a solid foundation. And people need to know that you view that as important.
Sure. You know, and we certainly don't want our listeners to feel as though they're trapped in some kind of regulatory cornfield maze with no exit. You know, what proactive opportunities do you see for franchisors, and also what defensive tactics are there to help avoid any pitfalls?
Well, you know, I think we have to step back. I mean, we're really talking here about making franchise sales. I mean, that's the whole goal. And we have been focusing on the requirements and best practices, but it really is your goal. And I mean, why comply with all this unless there's some great benefit? The great benefit is you're building your system and bringing good people into your system. So in terms of these technicalities are one thing. It's you need to have also under those, you have to have a good customer experience that you're offering to people. I mean, you need to be changing with the times, and your disclosure document needs to show that you're changing with the times, that you're up to date. It needs to be clear in terms of when you can compete with your franchisees, when you can't compete, so that everybody's on the same page. Otherwise, you're dealing with crises when people find out later that they didn't really understand what they were getting into. So you want to be building something, giving people all this information that's required, but also very helpful to the people, so that they know what they're getting into and that you can deal with those issues as they come up when they become your franchisees. Because that's a long. I mean, what we're talking about, these requirements only apply during those first month or two of communications, and then you have a 10 or 20 year relationship that you're trying to work towards. In that regard, I mean, the one key area is your existing franchisees. I mean, if you don't, you can have the greatest compliance and the greatest disclosure documents, but if your franchisees are not happy, if they're not validating your system, that's a pitfall because you're required in the disclosure document to give all the names and addresses and telephone numbers of those existing franchisees. The prospects these days are very educated on the internet and through other means. They're likely to call people, and if you're not going to get validation, that's going to basically counteract all your great efforts to comply with the franchise law. One area of a pitfall and also an opportunity is that brokers, independent people who help you to find prospects and link you up with appropriate prospects are a fantastic opportunity. They also raise issues about communication. Is there miscommunication between you and them? Or do they understand your culture of compliance? Are they committed to your system the way you are? I mean, these are all issues that you need to address so that there's a tremendous opportunity working with these brokers, but at the same time, you have to bring them into your culture and let them know how you want to conduct franchise sales. Otherwise, what they do and say can affect you and whether or not you're making legal franchise sales. Also, today, of course, so much is on the internet, so you do need to have a robust a website, maybe even social media presence, but all of those areas are regulated by the laws. So you do need to, if you're going to create new marketing materials or update your website or get involved in social media very heavily, you do need to check with your attorney to make sure that there are appropriate disclaimers included. It may just that just including some disclaimer language on your website will exempt you from most from all the franchise laws that would otherwise require registration. So those are, I mean, it's, you need to be active in that area, but at the same time, you need to know that there are some minimum requirements. And then in the area of financial performance representations, I think we'll talk about that later. That would be when you're giving people who are looking to buy a franchise with you any type of information about sales, average sales, ranges of sales, and percentage costs, profits. That would be a financial performance representation, used to be called earnings claims, and those are regulated. They are very helpful. A lot of franchisers don't use them. Some use them, and those who use them, I think, have found them to be very helpful.
Hey, Warren, this is Joe. I do have a question, but I want to go back to your terminology of culture of compliance for just a second, and I love the fact that you've really kind of named an activity that franchisors should embrace and make part of their organization, and it's something that I was doing when I was at the various franchisors that I've worked for, and I really didn't know I was doing establishing and cultivating a culture of compliance. But once a year, I would bring in our franchise law firm to do kind of a compliance tune-up with not just the franchise sales department, but with key people throughout the company, and so that they understood what we were trying to achieve, and that a compliance was a company thing, not a franchise development department thing. And I wondered if you ever engage in that, and if that's something that you'd recommend our audience add to their toolkit.
I highly recommend that, and I do that with several of my clients. Annually is extremely helpful. What I like about those is when I attend those types of meetings, I hardly have to talk. Generally, I will sit at a meeting and I'll encourage everyone who might be in any way involved in franchise sales to come and sit around the table. So that would be the president, the vice presidents, the administrative people, maybe the marketing people. And they sit around the table and basically start talking with each other about different issues. I may raise some questions, but they end up communicating with each other, and they find out that what they're doing isn't always consistent, or what they thought was happening isn't always happening. It's a fascinating experience, and it needs to be done annually, because 1 year it may be the focus may turn into very much a focus on systems and administration. Another year, maybe they're in a heavy growth mode. It might be on how to support the new people that are coming in, how to make sure that the people are being transitioned in properly. So there's as a franchisor matures, and also dealing with the recession and other issues that come up, the issues are different every year. The focus is different every year, and you only have limited resources, so you need to focus on different things from year to year. So they are extremely helpful, and you find out as the president of the company or as the vice president in charge of sales, you will find things out from people that you maybe didn't know, because normally you don't sit down and just listen to people talk in terms of what they do.
Fantastic. I think everybody should take your advice.
And it may be complimentary. You know, it may be something that the attorney offers, you know, that is billable, or it may be something that they would do as on a complimentary basis. So that would be up between you and your lawyer. I'm not saying it should be complimentary, but it could be. It helps everybody because you don't want.
Ways.
What's that?
I've had it both ways, and you know what? If it wasn't complimentary, it was at tied with other business, and it was certainly cost-effective. And a preventative measure like having a tune-up on compliance it can be invaluable. And once you do it, you'll realize it, because you will discover things that you might be a little embarrassed that are going on, and it gives you an opportunity to remedy those practices.
Right, and there are situations where you may even have had a recent problem, and we've run into that, where they maybe have run into a problem, and maybe they didn't violate violated the law inadvertently, or made a mistake. Sometimes those can be fixed. Not always, but sometimes they can be fixed. So why not try to fix them?
You know, Warren, I have to ask, if I'm a franchisor and someone internal to my team or an external agent like a franchise broker makes an unintentional or possibly an intentional violation, what are the penalties?
Well, I would say the most common penalty is if you do have a culture of compliance, that you'll lose the franchise sale potentially, or delay the franchise sale, because there are in many franchise systems, they have checklists. It goes to the attorney or it goes to the administrator, and if the checklist if there aren't checks on every box, the sale may not occur. So if you're the one trying to sell and you didn't follow one of the procedures, then you may lose that sale, perhaps a commission or your job eventually, if you're not making sales that are legal. So the biggest penalty would be losing sales or delaying sales, causing problems and inefficiencies. But in terms of if it turns out that you made a mistake, and sometimes you can fix it, as I mentioned, and cure it before it causes damage. But if it turns out maybe you made a mistake, you didn't even know you made it, and then someone complains later, the most likely scenario is that there would be a private threat of some type of even arbitration or lawsuit from the actual franchisee who bought, and they would say that they were hurt by that violation. Their remedies vary by state, but they can include that they would have the right to attorney's fees, damages. Maybe they could get rescission, which would mean all their money would have to be returned to them. So there are various remedies that they could seek. It would depend tremendously on what state they're in as to what remedies they'd have. They would have there would be time periods they might have to sue within 1, 2, 3, or 4 years, depending on the law. But those are all potential penalties. Another frequent penalty is that the state regulators might receive a complaint, and that could be from a disgruntled franchisee in most situations, or even a disgruntled competitor who thinks you're doing something wrong. They might go to the state and say this person's making offers for sales and they're not registered. And if that's the case, the state can investigate you and then require you to enter into some order. I will not violate the law going forward, and that would be an order that would probably have an indefinite life and would have to be reported in your disclosure document indefinitely until maybe someday you could eliminate it. But that would be not only the negative of having that type of a disclosure in your disclosure document, but also the cost of disclosing and maintaining those disclosures. Probably the least likely result would be some type of a Federal Trade Commission action. The Federal Trade Commission has limited resources. They will come in and get involved if there's a nationwide or a very broad-based fraud occurring. A lot of their focus is on business opportunities where a lot of people are being defrauded. That generally doesn't apply to franchisers. Generally, in the case of a franchisor, it would be case by case. You made a mistake in one state. The FTC is not going to get involved in that type of situation. But when they do get involved, and they have in the past gotten involved against what they consider to be nationwide practices, they have significant civil penalties that they can impose.
Warren, this is Joe. I've got a couple of questions. I was going to ask them separately, but I think I'm going to put them together. What should a franchisor absolutely not do when they discover a violation, and what course of action should they take in the instance where they've discovered a violation, either through their administrative controls and good practices that they have, or they get surprised by it because they don't have the controls in place.
The thing you should absolutely not do is ignore it. If you ignore it, you don't even know if it's fixable. You don't even know how bad it is. You don't even know what penalties are involved. So don't ignore it. It needs to go to a person who can make a decision about how to deal with it. And then once you admit that you're not ignoring it, or you take that effort, there's a full range. There's no one answer in terms of what you need to do. And you need to remember that in this situation, if you have in-house lawyers or outside lawyers, you need to talk to them about it. And there may be that it can be cured. It may be that it wasn't as bad. Maybe it's not even a violation. Maybe you think it was, but it wasn't, because there's some exemption that you didn't even know about that applies. So it's just something where you need to face it. It may be that you don't make the sale. Or it may be that you make the sale, but you make disclosures to the person before you make the sale, or you redisclose them. It may be that you hope that it goes away. You know, if it's something that happened a year ago and it was a one-off type situation, it may be that you don't run to the state, and you don't necessarily always run to the state and admit that there was one problem that occurred. It may be that you just let it ride, and hopefully it fades into the past over time, and no one can really complain about it. Or it may be that you decide, okay, this is something that we really need to let the state know about, because we don't want them coming in later and complaining and finding out that this occurred, and then maybe they would be less sympathetic to us. So it's a wide range of solutions. But the main thing is, don't ignore it. Don't pretend it didn't happen. Deal with it as early as possible.
So, Warren, when it comes to violations of state franchise sales laws, registration, where there's little risk of an action by a franchisee, is it better to let sleeping dogs lie, or should you voluntarily report to the state that you, for example, sold a franchise without being registered in that state?
It's often better to let sleeping dogs lie, but it depends on the severity. I mean, if it's something that where you made many, many sales in a state because you misunderstood and you thought you were effective and you weren't, that when you come to renew or when you come to register with the state, that may be so obvious that you don't really want to be in a position where the state says, you know, you were just ignoring the law for this extended period of time. So in that situation, you may go to the state and look, we made a mistake, and we'd like to work it out. And now they may require you to offer rescission to those people. So, I mean, there are consequences. They're not just going to say, thank you very much, that was nice of you to let us know that. So there are consequences, and you have to know what the consequences are. But there are many situations. I mean, maybe you find out that 2 years ago you forgot, you didn't follow the 14-day rule or the 10-day business day rule, something, but the franchisee's happy and it was an isolated situation. In that situation, I don't think you're going to want to go to the state or go to the franchisee. I mean, if they're happy and the state's happy, it's probably best to let it ride. And it's at some point, hopefully, it will become something that just is no longer relevant. But that's a judgment.
Yeah,
you have to make that judgment.
I understand
with your lawyer.
Certainly in a severe situation. I think a good rule of thumb is that, you know, a franchisor should never try to cover up or paper up a severe violation.
Well, you don't.
We're
you don't
closing
ever...
into the about 10 minutes left. It's about 12 minutes left in this segment of Franchise Today. My guest is Warren Lee Lewis of Ackerman Centerfeet. And again, I'm happy to announce to our listeners that Warren will send you a free signed copy of his desk reference book, The Franchise Seller's Handbook. Again, you know, all you have to do is email Warren at warren.lewis@ackerman.com with franchise handbook or franchise book in the subject line, or also, you know, you can go ahead and do that on Franchise Today's Facebook page. You know, Warren, in the time we have left, I'd like to focus on item 19, financial performance representations, FPRs, or as still many commonly still call earnings claims. I mean, FPRs are confusing for new franchisors and their teams, but I have to say that Joe and I run into some seasoned franchise executives that are stunningly misinformed when it comes to compliant and non-compliant FPRs. And if you would, why don't you explain FPRs to us, dispelling the myths, and give us a roadmap in effectively using FPRs as a franchising tool?
Well, if you as a franchisor want to provide prospects with any kind of sales information, like the sales of your unit sales, average or otherwise ranges, or any type of information of that type, or percentage cost numbers, such food is a certain percentage of sales, or labor is a certain percentage of sales, or any type of number like that, or any type of net profit or gross profit number, that needs to be in the disclosure document, in the item 19 of the disclosure document. Now, there are, and so that it must be there. Once it's there, then you can talk to people within the context of what is there. It can even be put in advertisements. As long as it stays within the context of what is it within the disclosure document, you cannot go beyond. You can't explain beyond what's in the disclosure document. The advantage of putting it in the disclosure document is that you can also have extensive footnotes, and you can explain things. Generally, we do it this way. You can include, you may be able to increase sales. This is the reason for the variances in sales. I mean, you can give a lot of background information so that you really have a great talking piece when you're dealing with people, if they're focused on how much am I going to make, which I would say that most franchisees are focused on that issue to a great extent. Now, anything said outside the disclosure document must be consistent with the disclosure, with the item 19 FPR. Now, in the situation where you have a locational type franchise, like a food outlet or a hotel or a retail type location franchise, it's very reasonable for the prospect to believe that you have that information. I mean, I would say it'd be extremely rare if you were operating a restaurant type franchising, you didn't know what your cost of goods were, food and labor, rent, that type of thing. So it's reasonable for them to know that you have it. So it's basically goes against common sense that you'd say, no, I'm not going to give any of that to them. Where you're in a more of a service-oriented business, where it might be a territorial distribution system or territorial services, where your sales are highly variable and your costs are highly variable, some people may be generating no sales and some may be generating $1 million in sales. In those types of situations, it's less likely that the person's really going to expect to get numbers, because they may realize that it would be difficult to know exactly, you know, what profitability is, or it very much depends on your actual your effort that you put into it. So any numerical information of the type I just described needs to be in the disclosure document. Now, there is some confusion because, of course, you're required in other parts of the FDD to give numbers. I mean, for example, you're required to give all your fees. You're required to give initial investment numbers. So you are in some ways required to give information, which is sort of like an earnings claim, but in other situations you're prohibited from giving it. Now, you're never, ever prohibited from giving it. You're just permitted to give it, and that's your choice. About, I would say, 20 to 30% of franchisors choose to do it. That means about 70% don't do it, and they still make franchise sales.
Yeah, I think the key thing is within context, which is where many franchise pros obviously get it wrong and add more than what is actually in the FPR.
Right. Just because you have an FPR doesn't mean you can just talk about anything. I mean, if you want to talk about any type of cost, as a percentage of revenue, for example, that needs to be in the FPR. Then you can talk about it. But if you don't include that cost in your FPR, but you've included other costs, then you can't just go off and give them percentages that aren't included in the FPR. Now, one area that I find, and this has changed somewhat under the rule, in the area of pro formas, either paper pro formas that you give to people or Excel spreadsheets, the new law is that if those are blank, other than categories of costs and revenue, if they're blank, you cannot put them in the FDD, the franchise disclosure document, but they can be used outside of the franchise disclosure document. So you would have they could do their own fill in the blanks of the spreadsheet, but at least you would be giving them categories of costs and categories of revenues that they might expect, but without any numbers. Whereas if those performas include numbers, well, then they need to be in the disclosure document.
I see. Joe, did you have any last questions regarding FPRs that you think our audience would be interested in?
Yeah, I think Warren covered it pretty well, but I'm still astonished by the conventional wisdom that expressed amongst franchise sales professionals. You know, I've been at some of the franchise expos and where a franchisor has an item 19 financial performance representation. They're using it very effectively in presenting to a prospect at in this case a trade show, and then they blow the whole thing up by saying to the prospect, "Oh, and we just opened up 3 stores, and this is what their sales were." Warren, you know, why does it seem so difficult for some people to understand that you can't do that?
Well, it's just common sense. It's new. It's the latest news. You know, that's what we all, I mean, we want to share good news with people, and people want to hear it, and they want to know what happened, you know, what's happened lately. And so I think it's just common, you know, people just figure that's something people want. It's helpful to them. Why shouldn't they have it? But it's just you can't do it. Now, and another exception I hadn't mentioned is that you, even if you don't have a disclosure document, an FPR in your disclosure document, you can, like if the person's looking to buy a particular unit, you can give all the financials for that particular unit because that's like buying an existing business, and so it's very typical that, I mean, you are able to give all relevant financials for that particular unit, but if you can't give it, if someone's looking to buy another unit, you can't give the financials for the other unit that they're not looking to buy.
Yeah, Warren, I had an interesting call a while back from a franchisor that asked me, and they said they've got a really great candidate. This company had an earnings claim, but the franchise prospect didn't think it was enough, and they came up with an interesting idea based on what you just said, that they knew that there was a resale that was in a neighboring state. It wouldn't be something that candidate would be interested in buying, but they wondered if it would be okay if they told that candidate to pose as a buyer and get that information from the broker that was handling that resale. I
right.
told him that would be a bad idea.
Yes, I would say. Yeah, I mean, it has to
be
real.
I think we could go on with another show about that type of scenario and also some other points in the franchise sales handbook, the franchise seller's handbook, especially with respect to shills and what have you. Warren, I really appreciate you being a guest again on Franchise Today, and again, specifically within our third annual Franchise Legal Series. We really appreciate your time, but more importantly, your effort in trying to dispel the myths for all the franchise sellers out there in the franchise community. Thanks again.
Thank you. I want people to make franchise sales that are good. So hopefully
yep.
this will be
That's what it's all about. And again, I want to remind our listeners, Warren will send you a free signed copy of the Franchise Seller's Handbook. All you have to do is email him at warren.lewis@ackerman.com with franchise book in the subject line, or make your request through Facebook on Franchise Today's page. Joe, again, thanks for another great show. Tell us real quick about next week's show.
Well, next week's show, we've got Ken Prine, and he's going to talk about litigation, and I think we're going to learn some new things about litigation. There's always something new and interesting happening, and we look forward to having Ken on the show.
Well, until then, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.